The Stony Man warriors arrived at the San Diego moorage early the next morning to pick up their boat for the trip south.
Well, one thing I'll say about Barbara, that woman sure knows how to arrange a first-class ride. I'm almost going to enjoy this little vacation.
Since Hawkins was still recovering from the shrapnel wound he had picked up at Chinbaki, he had drawn the short straw for the wrap-up operation. That meant that he would be at the helm of the yacht Rosario Blancanales had requisitioned from the San Diego office of the DEA. The boat had been confiscated in a drug bust, and the drug agency had been more than willing to loan it to a Justice Department special agent. They had also been willing to let him borrow some heavy firepower, no questions asked, and provide the customs clearance for the operation. It was a real good example of federal interdepartmental cooperation, and it had been accomplished without having to get Hal Brugnola involved. Blancanales' cover story invoking national security ensured that it would stay that way. The phone numbers he had given the DEA involving several cutouts all rang at Stony Man Farm, not the Justice Department. The additional weapons and ammunition Blancanales and Bolin had signed for were already stored below decks, and the boat was fully provisioned for a week's sail. All they had to do was take her out and set a course south to Baja.
I love the name. Risky Business. You'd think a drug dealer would know better than to advertise like that.
Oh, there's a lot of real dumb bastards in that particular business.
And we're going after one more of them. Well, since you're going to be the captain for this trip, TJ, I guess I'd better show you which end of this thing is the front and how to make it go.
Now, what are you talking about, man? I know all about boats. My granddad had the best little catfish boat you ever saw, and it had a real good little 12-horse motor on the back.
Come here. I'm going to show you a real boat motor, one that you don't have to hang over the side of the boat.
Yeah, I thought there was something funny about the back of this boat. I didn't see a motor.
The back of the boat is called the stern.
Whatever.
The yacht was 25 miles out to sea when the radio in the wheelhouse came alive.
Phoenix, this is Flyboy. I'm inbound ETA 05. Clear the deck and prepare to receive aircraft. Over.
Roger, Flyboy. You're clear to land.
Hi, guys. How do you like my new ride? A Hughes 500? That bird's okay, but your flying sure as hell hasn't gotten any better. You must think that you're still behind the wheel at Adventure Star. That was a fun ride, but I'll take a gunship any day. You just can't throw a space shuttle around the way you can a chopper. Speaking of guns, where are yours? They're stowed in the back where the seats usually go. I didn't want to draw too much attention to myself back at the airfield by mounting them there. There were a lot of civilians hanging around. Jack, your Hughes is matte black and completely devoid of any markings save its U.S. registration number on a tail boot. Guns aside, you probably started another wave of black helicopter government conspiracy call-ins to talk shows all over Southern California. That's okay, just as long as they don't mistake me for an alien. I'm 100% red-blooded American, born and bred.
You could only be an American, lad. The way you fly, only Uncle Sam would claim you.
Request permission to come aboard.
Permission granted.
Thank you, Captain. Now, where's the women?
Hey, Akira.
Hi, Barb. Hi, Kat.
Where's Bear?
Oh, he's taking a nap. This way, we can keep round-the-clock surveillance of Montoya's villa.
Oh, I didn't know Bear actually slept.
So how's it look today?
I still have that one ship holding offshore.
The Hong Kong registry?
That's the one. I looked it up in Lloyd's, and it's called the Spring Rain. The other one turned out to be legit, and it went on its way.
Tag that ship. If it starts to come closer to shore, I want to know immediately.
I already have it marked.
What about those trucks we've been seeing?
There haven't been any more since yesterday, so that might be the end of it.
The wrap-up wasn't only aimed at eliminating Lynn and Montoya, but was also designed to destroy the shipment of high-tech contraband Lynn was believed to be taking back to China with him. Every one of the trucks that had showed up at the villa over the past 2 days had offloaded cargo into the outbuildings on the compound. Captain Ellenbogen had also been following both the recon and the progress of the risky business as she sailed south. While Takedo had been watching the trucks and the freighter, he had been trying to count the people at the villa. From what he had been able to see, there were at least 10 men on the grounds at all times, day and night. That was many more than would be needed for any kind of legitimate work around the place during the day, and the men on the night shift had to be purely security. But that many men meant that there was something there that Montoya felt was worth guarding.
What do you think, Katz?
Well, the risky business is on station, and they're ready to launch on command. I think we've seen enough, and we'd better do it now before something gets in the way or the target disappears. We have all the information we need to make the strike, and there's no point in putting it off. We also need to get this wrapped up before Hal comes back.
You know, if I didn't know any better, I'd think that he took off specifically to give us time to do this.
He is a sneaky bastard, and I wouldn't put it past him to do something like that to us. Which is all the more reason that we need to have them launch as soon as they can. We don't want him coming back unannounced and catching us with our fingers in the cookie jar.
Or on the trigger. Akira, give them the update and tell Stryker it's his call. He's clear to go whenever he wants.
After talking it over with Katzenellenbogen, Bolin had opted to make a pre-dawn insertion. With Grimaldi flying air cover for them, a daylight raid made more sense. So while the risky business stayed well offshore that night, the Stony Man crew kept watch over the target.
The spring rain's coming closer to shore, and she's got her lights off.
Let's see it.
Sure. Look at that picture. Clear as day. I tell you, night vision technology has really leapt forward recently.
The freighter's maneuvered to within 1,000 yards of the shoreline, and it looks like she's lowered her anchor. She's either going to move cargo or personnel. Judging from the recent trucks, I'd opt for a cargo transfer. Keep an eye on her and tell me how many loads she's taking on.
You going to pass this on to Stryker?
Give him a heads up and tell him we'll be keeping an eye on them. If the ship heads out to sea before dawn, we may need to board her.
The currents around the tip of Baja California, where the Pacific Ocean and the Gulf of California met, could be tricky. It made for good fishing, but small boats needed an expert hand at the wheel or the tiller. That spelled good business for the resorts and the fishing boat captains of Cabo. At the turn of the tides, however, the waters calmed enough for even personal watercraft to play in the waves. It was during one of those pre-dawn calms that the risky business pulled in close to the shore with her lights out and anchored in a little cove south of Cabo San Lucas. The black Zodiac inflatable boat with the muffled motor was quickly put over the side. Able Team loaded their heavy weapons and ammunition into the boat, and James took them into shore. As soon as the boat had been pulled back on board, Hawkins started his engines, cast off, and went back out to sea, heading east this time. When they were below the horizon, he steered north, sailing back past Montoya's villa. Half an hour later, he turned into the shore again. This time, Grimaldi piloted the Zodiac inflatable boat to take Phoenix Force into the beach. When he came back, Hawkins took his boat back out far enough to be well down over the horizon again. Now that the teams had disembarked, Hawkins was feeling a little lonely. He still had Jack Grimaldi for company, but he would have much rather been with his comrades. After being dropped on the coastline 5 miles north of Montoya's villa, the Phoenix Force warriors had moved into good observation positions and were sitting tight while the rest of the operation came together. Since Able Team had drawn the more difficult opening move, the timing was dependent upon their progress. After Able Team had landed outside of Cabo San Lucas, Blancanales had gone into town to rent a four-wheel drive rig and had driven it back to the Cape to pick up his teammates and their heavy weapons. From there, they had driven up into the hills as far as the four-wheel drive vehicle would go. When they could drive no farther, the mortar, RPG, and the ammunition would have to be put into position overlooking the villa. Once the mortar was in place, the fun could begin. On the fantail of the yacht, Jack Grimaldi was making a full systems check after mounting the weapons packages on his helicopter. He was very familiar with both the chopper and the armament systems, but it never hurt to double-check everything. For this mission, he had opted for a single 7.62mm minigun and four of the 7-round 2.75-inch rocket pods. That gave him the best mix of high-explosive and automatic weapons fire without overburdening the small bird. Even so, with 12,000 rounds of 7.62mm ammo on board, he was going to be heavy until he started using it. When Grimaldi finished and went up to the bridge, Hawkins glanced to the chopper sitting on the aft deck.
That's a bit of a comedown after flying the Venture Star, isn't it?
Not really. It was great to put a few spacecraft hours in the old logbook, but I prefer to fly a little closer to the ground. You don't have to worry about running out of oxygen in a chopper. Plus, except for that laser lash up on the Atlantis, space shuttles don't carry guns. Half the fun of flying is the shooting.
Kara Lyons swept the expanse of rock one more time before signaling for Gadget Schwartz and Rosario Blancanales to move out again. The three ABLE Team commandos were wearing desert camouflage uniforms, and they blended in perfectly with the rocks of the arid terrain they were traveling through. Baja could be a tropical paradise as long as you hugged the coastline tightly, but once you got inland, it was rocky and barren. Schwartz was struggling noticeably under the weight of the 81mm mortar tube. ABLE Team usually didn't go in for heavy weapons, but since the assault needed to look like a military operation, the 81mm was called for. Rather than drag around the heavy base plate and tripod that was used to support and sight an 81mm tube, Lyons had taken a shortcut. They had brought only the tube itself and would fire it by jamming the ball end of the barrel into the ground and holding onto it with a pair of asbestos gunner's gloves. Accuracy was a bit dicey firing it that way, but a good gunner could sight it by eye. Also, all 10 of the 81mm HE rounds they had brought had been pre-cut to charge one, so the recoil wouldn't punish the guy holding the tube. It was an old guerrilla warfare solution to lightweight, mobile, heavy firepower that had been proved on many battlefields. And if they really wanted accurate shooting, they had the RPG-7 rocket launcher Blancanales was packing. When the Mexican Federales got around to surveying what was left of Montoya's villa, it would look as if it had been hit by a large force, much larger than the Stony Man team.
The man's got a lot of security down there for a summer house. I count almost 24 men.
That's not so much for a drug runner, but I haven't seen any heavy weapons, have you?
None, and only a few prepared positions. This should be a piece of cake compared to the China op. We've even got satellite overwatch this time around.
If he has a couple of 50s stashed in the shrubbery, it could make things difficult for us.
That's what we have Jack on hand for. He's good at taking out the heavy stuff.
We don't want to have to call on him until the grand finale. If he uses up all his ordnance and fire support, we'll have to blow that place ourselves, and I don't want to stick around that long. The Federales may not be all that great at rapid response, but I'd rather not chance it.
Gary won't mind, though.
And Carl might have some mortar ammunition left over as well.
Oh, wait a sec.
What did you find?
I'm monitoring the air traffic patterns right now, and I've picked up a track outside the normal flight patterns. I think I've got a chopper inbound to Cabo San Lucas, and it's headed straight for our guys' complex.
I'll call up our boys and tell them to take cover.
You hear that?
Yeah. Cover to your five.
Is that...
That's a bell. 4:30. That's no civilian. Get your field glasses out. Who's getting out?
Looks like our man Montoya is having an Oriental guest.
If Lin is down there, that would fit. And my guess is that he's from the mainland.
That means we have two people we don't want to kill. I know someone's going to want to talk to him, too.
No. No one's talking to anyone this time. We're sending a message, pure and simple.
Welcome, General Sean. How are you this fine day?
I'm fine. Are you going to show me in?
Of course. This way, General Sean. As we say here, General, my house is your house. Is there anything I can get for you, or would you like to rest before we begin? I know it was a long flight.
I am rested now, thank you. I was able to sleep much of the way from Hong Kong. Before we start, though, I would like to see Dr. Lin.
Oh, I will get him. Excuse me for saying, but your accent...
I have studied English for a long time. Longer than you, apparently. I remember asking for you to get me Dr. Lin. Did you not understand?
Oh, of course, General Shan. Right away. General Shan, I present to you Dr. Lin.
General Shan? The Technical Intelligence Bureau Chief? Oh, ni hao. It is going to be strange for me to be back in the mother country. I have lived away for so long that it seems like a dream to me. I think it will take me a while to get used to it again.
You'll not be going back to the mother country right away.
You don't want me to stay in America, do you?
No, Lin. As you well know, that would be foolish. You are to be attached to our embassy in Mexico City, where you are to continue the work you were doing in California. Montoya will continue to be your conduit for moving the needed technical material out of the United States.
But that will be almost as dangerous as being in California, General. The Yankees are known for crossing the border and kidnapping people they want to prosecute. If they learn that I'm there, I will be in danger every minute I remain in Mexico.
You will be well guarded. In fact, for your protection, you will not be allowed to leave the embassy grounds.
How long can I expect to be there, General?
As long as it is necessary for you to be there. You will run your network from Mexico City and continue to provide information and equipment to the mother country. This setback has disrupted our plans, and we must make up for it. Your network is still intact, though, and you will continue to work through it as you did before.
It will be more difficult to do my work from Mexico. Part of my success in California was that I had access to the best aerospace engineering firms in the world because of my position at the university. Well, that is gone now, and I am certain that the Yankee security agencies will be contacting everyone I ever worked with to tell them to be on guard against any further contact with me. Without that network to call upon, it will not be as easy as it was before.
Your operation will change, that is true. But you still have your hand-picked agents like Delgado, who are working on the inside. In the past, you have indicated that they are completely loyal to you. Is there any reason to believe that will have changed?
No. I believe that most of them will continue their activities.
They had better. Your future depends on them doing just that.
When do I leave?
I will be staying here until this shipment is loaded, and you will go back when I do. Until then, enjoy yourself while you can. Mexico City does not have air this clean.
Iron Man, this is Stryker. We're in place. Anytime you're ready, go for it.
Give me another three.
When General Shan dismissed Dr. Lin Chu to go back to his room, he and Carlos Montoya started to go over the invoices of the equipment waiting to be loaded into the Hong Kong freighter waiting offshore. With the Venture Star back in American hands, the hopes of Chinese space power had crumbled. For the mother country to become a great space power, her engineers would have to start work on the stalled CZ-4 Great Leader launch vehicle program again. If that massive rocket could be made reliable, new missile platforms could be put into orbit again, and the game would go on. But before the CZ-4s would be reliable, the engineers were going to have to incorporate a great deal of borrowed American technology into the design. Hopefully, the material stored in the outbuildings around the villa would help meet those needs.
Yes, this is just what we will need. We are also in need of Illudium Q-36.
What was that?
I do not know. My guards are not doing anything with explosives today. This is Montoya. Report! Report!
Oh. Oh. You told me that this place was secure. You know I cannot afford to be caught in your country.
Guards, we are under attack by... My Porsche!
Your Porsche is nothing. This is mortifier. We are being hit by a strike force.
I don't understand. I paid so much money to the Mexican authorities, I could shoot down people in the street and not get stopped.
Obviously, you haven't paid enough to keep someone from talking to the Yankees. I cannot be captured, Montoya. It is in your best interest that the People's Liberation Army not become your enemy.
Fire in the hole!
Been waiting to let loose, have you?
Oh, who the hell's shooting at us?
I've got a half a dozen men around 300 yards, a little to the left of the garage, coming up the hill.
I've got them. Load me, gadgets. Fire in the hole! About 12 yards short. Okay, I got it. Load! Fire! All right, they're running away. Well, those who can.
Good. Now I can get back to taking out the buildings. Load! Fire!
What is happening, General?
My guess is that your Yankee friends have come to take you back. You must be more important to them than I thought.
But how did they learn that I was here?
That is none of my concern. I am going to the boats.
What is going to happen?
I have no idea. I only know that we cannot allow you to be captured alive. Your interrogation would set our plans back 20 years.
What should I do?
Here. There's an arms rack by the door. This is an MP5. And this
is a Beretta 92.
What are you doing?
I'm going back to the mother country now.
Then what about me?
You, Lin Chu, are going to stay right here.
Sean stepped over Lin's body without giving it a glance and headed for the elevator. If he could get to the freighter, he would be safe. If Montoya should somehow win this battle, he would come back for the rest of the stockpiled equipment. If not, he would cut his losses and return to China with what had already been transferred. Under the covering fire of Lyons's 81mm mortar, the Stony Man commandos had moved to the edge of the compound. Advancing into the face of oncoming mortar fire was always a tricky affair, particularly a handheld mortar. But by keeping Lyons informed of where they were, they should be able to keep out of the line of fire. When they took up positions to wait out the last of the mortar fire, Manning unlimbered his Winchester sniper's rifle and started to look for targets. If they worked this right, all they'd have to face when they got in among the buildings was a cleanup operation. That was preferable to doing a building-to-building rat hunt.
Stryker, that's the last of the 81mm rounds. I think we softened them up for you.
Roger, good work. Just keep that RPG ready in case we run into any hard points.
We've got our side and the road out well covered. They won't be coming through this end.
When General Sean made his way to the lower-level boathouse, he saw that there were half a dozen cargo handlers from the spring rain standing around anxiously. Since the freighter's crewmen were PLA naval arm personnel, they were armed, but no one had told them what to do.
Take your weapons and help our Cuban friends fight off the Yankees. I am going out to the ship to get reinforcements.
Now that they had been commanded, the Chinese sailors ran for the stairs that led to the surface, leaving Sean alone to make his escape. Montoya had several powerboats tied up, one of them an 18-foot speedboat with a 220-horse outboard motor.
Perfect. Full tank.
Lyons's mortar attack had also been the signal for Jack Grimaldi to take to the air in his minigun ship. The black chopper, now hung with the rocket pods and the centerline minigun mount, rose off the risky business's fantail and turned toward the shore. He dropped down to wavetop level and racked the throttle to 110% as he bore in on the spring rain. When he saw that the Chinese freighter had pulled up her anchor and was heading in closer to shore, he clicked on his mic.
Stryker, this is Flyboy. It looks like our freighter is coming in closer, as if they wanted to get involved. If she's packing heavy weapons, she might ruin our whole day. I'm going to try to change their minds.
Roger. We don't need to deal with offshore bombardment.
Since he was coming in so low, the Chinese didn't spot Grimaldi until he pulled up to flash over the top of the ship's masts. He saw the startled looks on the faces of the sailors as they dived for cover and saw the officers shouting orders from the bridge. In the bow of the freighter, sailors whipped back canvas covers to reveal twin machine cannon mounts. He didn't stick around long enough to firmly ID them, but they looked like the standard communist bloc 37mm anti-aircraft guns. The 2.75-inch rockets in his pods were more anti-personnel and soft-skin vehicle rounds than something one would choose to attack a ship. But the freighter shouldn't be packing any armor on her belt line. It was just a tramp freighter with a couple of guns welded to the deck, not a World War II Q-ship. The hull plates would be far less than an inch thick, and they would be cold-rolled steel, not armor plate. The two rockets could punch through them without much effort. Stomping down on the right rudder pedal and slamming the cyclic over against the stop, Grimaldi racked the chopper in a tight bank turn and came in on an attack run. With the chopper's skids barely clearing the water, he started triggering the rockets in pairs. The rockets hit a foot above the waterline and blew jagged holes in the hull plates, but they were too far up for water to pour in. The 37mm gun crew had finally gotten his number. Time to do some of that fancy flying he liked to brag about. Hauling up on the collective to pull maximum pitch to the spinning rotor blades, Grimaldi pulled the nimble Hughes into a zoom climb before laying it on its left side in a snap turn. As he flashed past the bridge, he triggered the minigun pod. As he flashed overhead, he saw blood spattered on the bridge windows. Once he had cleared the ship, he dropped back down to wavetop level, trying to keep the bulk of the freighter between him and the autocannon. 1,000 yards out, he snapped the speeding chopper into a pedal turn and came around to do it again. This time, he came in from the ship's starboard rear quarter. Those rockets hit in exactly the right place and blew holes in the hull at the waterline. As far as damage went, these weren't big holes, but they were big enough to let water in, which should be enough. No captain was going to risk further damage. But he still had to take care of the 37mm gun. General Shan gaped as he watched the small gunship chopper savage the ship he had expected to escape on. The crew of the Spring Rain were from the People's Liberation Army Naval Arm, but they were getting beaten like novices. As he turned the speedboat away, he saw an ocean-going yacht on the horizon several miles farther out. He didn't know if the boat had anything to do with this attack, but maybe it could serve as his escape out of a rapidly deteriorating situation. He had to reach international waters before the Mexican officials arrived. Under no circumstances could he allow himself to be captured.
Flyboy, this is Stryker. Montoya's taking off in his chopper, and we're not in position to take him under fire. I didn't see if the Chinese got on board too, but I need you to take it out.
I'm on him, Sarge.
He hauled back on the cyclic control and pulled maximum pitch to go into a zoom climb. When he reached 1,000 feet, he saw a Black Bell helicopter rise up over the cape before turning and dropping behind the cover of the sea cliffs. It was flying south and had a 10-mile head start on him. Twisting the throttle up against the stop, he fine-tuned the pitch to the rotor to get maximum RPM out of the screaming turbine. When he saw that Montoya's chopper was still pulling away from him, he reached out to trigger the release for the rocket pods, but thought better of it. He had only two rockets left anyway, and the drag was slowing him down. Glancing at the ammo counter for the minigun, he saw that he had only a little over 800 rounds left in the magazine. At 1,200 rounds per minute, that didn't give him much firing time, about 40 seconds. But unless the enemy chopper was armored like a gunship, a good 5-second burst should be enough to take care of it. There was little Hawkins could do on the risky business but watch the fight and listen to the comlink chatter over the radio. To make it worse, he didn't have anything heavier than his H&K subgun on board, so he had to keep out of range of the Chinese ship's machine cannon. He knew the kind of damage 37mm HE rounds would do to their ride home.
What the? Is that? Oh, shoot.
Flyboy, this is Phoenix 5. I got a speedboat coming right toward me at full throttle. I think it escaped from the villa, and I know I can't outrun it. If there's more than a couple of guys in it, I'm gonna have my hands full. Over.
Roger. Try to hang on for a bit, Phoenix 2. I'm tied up right now, but I'll get back to you as soon as I can.
Don't take too long. I'm setting the course parallel to the shoreline.
Hawkins engaged the boat's autopilot and reached for his H&K. It was time to prepare to repel boarders. Ducking into a stateroom, he looked around to see if someone had left some extra firepower behind. Maybe a loose grenade or two. It was too bad that they'd only brought one RPG with them.
The Mercs are pulling back to the main house, Stryker. Looks like they're joining up with our Chinese associates.
Can you stop them?
Not from up here.
Damn. Now we're gonna have to go in and dig them out. Give us support, Able Team.
Leaving the mortar tube behind, the three Able Team commandos grabbed the RPG launcher and headed down the hill to join their Phoenix Force comrades. This was the part of the operation they hadn't wanted to undertake, but battles had a way of taking their own direction. When General Shan got close enough to the yacht, he saw only one man in the wheelhouse and no one on the deck. When he saw that the fantail of the boat was big enough to land a small helicopter, everything clicked into place. He had found where the mystery gunship had come from and how the Yankees had been transported to Baja. He was a bit surprised to see that this wasn't a more massive operation, but was little more than a commando raid. It struck him, though, that the attack on Chinbaki had been a commando raid, too. It could be that the two were connected. Regardless, the yacht was now his objective, and he had to capture it. As soon as the rocket pods fell away from Grimaldi's speeding chopper, the airspeed indicator inched up and he slowly started to draw closer to Montoya's aircraft. Even so, with the head start it had, it was going to be a long chase. The little Hughes 500 was fast for her size, but the Bell 430 was much more powerful, and even though it was heavier, that extra power translated into speed. He had pulled to within a mile or so of the fleeing chopper when it suddenly whipped around and turned back into him. With a closing rate of almost 400 miles per hour, they were nose to nose in a flash. Even though the Bell wasn't wearing weapons mounts, her doors were slid back and men were leaning out with assault rifles. Grimaldi abruptly chopped his pitch and the Hughes fell out of the sky as the rotors lost lift. The enemy fire flashed over his head. Pulling pitch, he stomped down on the right pedal and let the rotor's torque snap his tail around so he was lined up with the enemy aircraft. The enemy pilot sideslipped as he racked his machine around into another attack run. Whoever was piloting that thing was good, but Grimaldi had flown gunships against the best pilots in the world, and this guy just wasn't in that category. That didn't mean, though, that he could afford to be sloppy. More good pilots had died from being sloppy than from bad luck. Jack Grimaldi was at a disadvantage in this fight because his minigun mount was fixed to fire forward. It had to be pointed directly at what he wanted to hit. Since the Bell had door gunners on each side, they could bring fire on him from almost any quarter and could keep him under fire even when he was flying away from them. An idea came to Grimaldi that could tip the odds in his favor, something his rigid rotor system was uniquely capable of doing. When the door gunner's fire made him break off his next pass, he flew past the Bell before racking his machine into a vertical climb. When he had gained several hundred feet, he pulled the Hughes over onto her back and for an instant was flying upside down. Pulling through the inside loop, he came down above Montoya's chopper and a little to the rear, with it fixed in his gun sight. When Grimaldi came out of his loop, the Bell was falling from the sky, trailing smoke and flame. The transmission had declutched, though, and the ship was auto-rotating enough that it didn't plunge nose-first into the ocean. A few yards above the wave tops, the pilot pulled pitch and managed to set his machine on the water right side up. Grimaldi saw at least two figures inside struggling to get free before it sank. Since this operation was intended to send a message, Grimaldi swooped over the floating wreckage for another pass. Even though no one would survive to pass the word on, if the bullet-riddled bodies were recovered, they would show that it was hazardous to one's health to operate against the United States. The Chinese might pay well, but they couldn't protect a person from the long arm of Uncle Sam.
Phoenix 5, I'm Bingo Ammo, but I'm on the way back. Phoenix 5, TJ, come in, TJ. Sarge, I'm on the way back, but I can't reach TJ.
We haven't heard from him either. You better check it out.
I'm on the way. Phoenix 4, we can't get close. What's the situation up there?
They've barricaded the doors and are shooting wildly at the windows. What, can't you get a shot?
Negative. We are pinned down. Are you in position?
Sure thing, Phoenix 1. I'm on the hillside with a good angle of fire.
Then what are you waiting for?
On it.
Phoenix 1 to Paul, you are clear to fire. Phoenix 4, continue cover fire.
Cover fire, he says. I'll show you cover fire.
Call to Phoenix 1, acknowledged. RPG 7, ready to fire.
Good shot, Paul. You took out the door of the patio. Now, just one more inside.
Acknowledged.
Is that it?
Everybody stay hot. I see movement.
They're charging!
Everybody, fire!
Is that all of them?
I think so. Why'd they all charge?
I guess they just wanted to die like men.
What a fucking waste.
Even though Sean believed that there was only one man on the yacht, he wasn't about to take any chances. He had his MP5 ready as he scrambled onto the deck. No one was in sight, but he saw an inflatable boat in the water. No one was in the boat either, but the outboard motor on the back was running at an idle. It looked as though the man he had seen on the bridge had tried to abandon his boat. Apparently, though, something had happened and he had gone over the side. If that was the case, the man's fate was of no importance to him, but he would search the yacht anyway. After clearing the top deck, Sean went up to the bridge and saw that the boat was on autopilot. He left it that way until he could complete his search. The door leading to the staterooms was closed, and he crouched beside the sill when he opened it. Peering down, he saw that the companionway was empty. Holding the MP5 in one hand and the pistol in the other, he started down into the dimly lit cabin. He was so intent on looking for his opponent that he didn't see the OD nylon cord lying across one of the steps.
Never try to sneak up on a ranger.
You guys can come back anytime you want now.
I got rid of the hitchhiker.
Roger. We're about done here as well.
Stony Man Farm, Virginia.
Hal, welcome back.
It's good to be back, Barb.
Well, you're looking rather chipper today.
Things are all in the green for a change. I think the man misplaced my extension number again.
Oh, did you happen to catch the CNN report on the shootout at the drug lord's villa down in Baja yesterday? It was the top of the hour story.
Yeah, I saw it last night. It only goes to show you that those drug gangs will do anything to eliminate their competition.
Yeah. There was also an interesting report from the Mexican Coast Guard in that same area, too. I don't think it made the news, but I saw it on the NSC intel summary this morning. It seems that one of their patrol boats picked up some Chinese sailors in a life raft off the Cape. It took some time before they could get an interpreter flown in from Mexico City so they could get their story.
And what was it?
Well, they claimed that they had been attacked by some kind of helicopter gunship that strafed and rocketed their ship. No one really believed that, but they were close enough to the tip of Baja, so it could be that whoever attacked the villa thought they were running drugs, too.
I guess you have to watch what neighborhoods you go into down there.
Particularly if you show up in the middle of a firefight.
Particularly then.
Anyway, has Stryker checked in with you lately?
The last thing I heard, he and the guys were fishing their way down to Puerto Vallarta.
That's great. Let them relax without bugging them, but make sure that they get that fancy boat back to the DEA when they're finished, will you? I don't want to have to pay for it.
Sure thing, Hal.
Colonel Greg Cunningham and the other two Atlantis astronauts were in pre-mission training at Vandenberg Air Force Base for another classified mission in space. This time, they were going up on the Endeavour to try to salvage their old shuttle. In a series of spacewalks, they would remove the damaged cargo bay doors and fit new ones in their place before trying to fly it home. Even damaged, a space shuttle was simply too valuable to abandon. If it was at all possible to repair the Atlantis, it would be returned to Earth intact. If it couldn't be salvaged, though, it would be sent crashing into the Pacific Ocean. One way or the other, it was coming back to Earth. The mission was not only to recover a valuable space shuttle, but there was also the brilliant Pebbles laser mounted in her cargo bay. It had proved to be a weapon of great potential, and the Alamogordo Weapons Development Center wanted it back at all costs. The president had instituted a new black project to make a series of laser weapons and get them ready for use in space immediately. If one enemy could mount a strike from orbit, another one could get the same idea, and America had to be defended. As with the original Atlantis mission, this flight was also wrapped in deep security. Again, no announcements were being made, and Bill Krueger had kept on the same team who had launched the earlier flight. The Delta Force security was still in place, although most of the gunships had returned to their bases.
Did you see the LA Times yesterday?
I'm afraid I did, Bradley. Why?
Well, it seems that there was some kind of major dust-up at some drug lord's villa on the tip of Baja, California. No one's accepting responsibility as yet, but when the Mexican authorities showed up to count the bodies, they found a Chinese-American aerospace engineering professor from Caltech among the dead. No one knows what he was doing down there, and particularly what he was doing with an ex-Cuban suspected of being in the drug business.
Interesting. Might be that our buddies were at work again.
I know what they told us, but that story was straight out of some paperback spy thriller. I'd like to know who they really were.
I guess we'll never know, will we, Boyd?
Colonel Gregory Cunningham did know, however, that his old wingman, Kurt Miller, had been avenged. He also knew that it would be a long time before anyone ever thought about hijacking an American space shuttle again. Stony Man, Star Venture is a graphic audio production. Stony Man, The Executioner, and Mac Bolan are trademarks owned by Harlequin Enterprises Limited, used by others under license. Copyright 2000, Worldwide Library, all rights reserved. Production copyright 2007, The Cutting Corporation, all rights reserved. Performed by Terrence Aselford, Richard Rowan, Jeff Baker, Dylan Lynch, James Lewis, Christopher Graybill, David Coyne, Dolores King-Williams, Thomas Penny, Ken Jackson, and Mort Shelby. Additional red shirts by The Dead Giveaways. Adapted for graphic audio and directed by Dan Smith. Produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. Dialogue editing and graphic audio sound design by Nathaniel Perry and Temeskin Wubna. The Stony Man theme was composed by Mark Ashby. Additional original music by Johann Detweiler and Nathaniel Perry. If you enjoyed Stony Man, be sure to look for Don Pendleton's Mac Bolan and The Executioner, available at Road Stops Everywhere at 1-800-670-5220 or at www.graphicaudio.net, where you'll find samples of all our Action Pump titles, as well as free downloadable extras, forums, and podcasts. Keep listening for a preview of another Graphic Audio title.
Available now from Graphic Audio.
Rogue Angel Number 2, Solomon's Jar.
With a rush, the fishermen were on them. Any doubts Anya entertained as to their seriousness were dispelled in a blink when one man took a horizontal swipe at her face with a torch. She punched the man who had swung the torch in her face. He sat down hard.
Aiden, stay behind me.
Anya pirouetted around a clumsy knife slash, smelling a waft of alcohol breath that accounted for much of the clumsiness. She dropped its originator, sprawling and gasping with an elbow at the back of the neck. Somehow she sensed it as a club swung at the back of her head. She bent forward sharply at the waist. She mule-kicked straight back, caught an ample abdomen with hard muscle beneath, and elicited a whoosh of forced out air as its owner was launched back several feet. Another man rushed her, club raised to crush her skull. She turned and charged past him, catching him with a forearm high on his chest that dumped him hard on his back and left him stunned and breathless. She stiff-armed a second attacker. Anya moved through the crowd of attackers in a controlled frenzy, allowing her training and reflexes free rein. Rather than block, she dodged, ducked, and weaved. In preference to kicking and punching, she grabbed and swung or simply pushed. She kept moving through her assailants, directing blows away from her, thrusting men into one another.
Keep your hands off me!
Then she heard Aiden shouting and she turned to glance back. The move undid her. Strong arms thrust beneath her armpits from behind. Huge hands clasped the nape of her neck. She was lifted kicking off the ground.
No!
A man closed with her from the front, empty-handed. She kicked him hard in the gut with both feet. Then Nomiki himself was before her, bandy-legged and mysterious as Pan in the shifting dark and torchlight. A blade protruded from his hand, with torchlight sluicing along it like the premonition of blood. Anya kicked the knife from his hand. Nomiki fell back as she kicked him in the face. But then her leg was seized, followed by the other, and more men piled on than she could kick away with all her strength. She realized she had made a potentially fatal mistake. She'd been holding back when her opponents were not. Someone's hands thrust her head forward, intending to snap her neck. Her neck muscles strained, popped, seemed to groan aloud as she fought his strength. She would not give in. She couldn't win, but that meant nothing to her resolve.
Tabata!
It was a male voice, high-pitched, harsh, with an accent and something more. As it penetrated Anya's fog, in which she had been aware of almost no sound since the fight began, it must have penetrated the consciousness of the mob swarming over her. The men actually did stop and paused in their sinister intent.
The following preview is of a Graphic Audio production rated for mature audiences due to scenes of intense violence and sexual situations.
The year is 2089. 100 years after a devastating Soviet nuclear attack, much of the United States is still radioactive and impassable. The Earth, literally blown off its axis, is now besieged by superstorms, massive and unpredictable. The world has 20% less oxygen and 90% fewer plants and animals. In the United States, the country has been torn by chasms, landslides, and earthquakes. Mutant animals roam the plains and mountains. People speak in whispers of the glowers, radioactive humans who live only in the hottest zones and whose touch kills instantly. 40 fortresses, huge military complexes, enforce the law of the land with an iron fist. American citizens are used as slave labor and forced to live in hovels on the outskirts. The nation's appointed president is General Zhabnov. He resides in what was once Washington, D.C., now renamed New Lenin. Welcome to the United Socialist States of America, part of the vast People's World Socialist Republics. Despair and death are everywhere. Hope is near extinction. But out of this hell will ride a man who believes in freedom, justice, and the complete annihilation of the occupying Russian forces. Ted Roczen, known with admiration as well as fear as the ultimate American, has not given up. A loose confederation of secret American free cities dots the countryside and awaits its time to rise and challenge the Soviet armies. They shall be led by Rock, the Doomsday Warrior.
This is Colonel Kilia. You've all been trained for this moment. You are elite troops, so I know that you are ready. This Ted Roczen must be taken alive. Destroy the others, but take Rock alive. The man that captures him will get 100,000 rubles and the Medal of the Supreme Soviet Hero. The man who kills him will die the most excruciating, painful death ever experienced on this earth. Am I understood?
Don't miss one pulse-pounding episode of Ryder Stacey's Doomsday Warrior series from Graphic Audio.
If you can't find that Graphic Audio title you're looking for, go to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can order it in CD format or digital download. If you're on the road, call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220 or www.graphicaudio.net.